WrestleSpective Radio is not affiliated with World Wrestling Entertainment, TNA Wrestling, Ring of Honor Wrestling, or any other sports entertainment entity or personality.
You're listening to WrestleSpective Radio. Learn to love it.
Hello and welcome to WrestleSpective. I am your host, Jason Mann, and returning to the program, he is the purveyor of one of the great YouTube channels of professional wrestling that there is in existence. It is Mike from Monsoon Classic. Mike, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Jason, for having me. You read my intro very well.
Oh, thanks. I appreciate that. Yeah, we should talk a little bit about your channel, because it's just really – I like that you – I mean, you've got thousands of matches on there, and they're not like – really, they're not pay-per-view matches. They're not really necessarily like narratively important matches for the most part. I'm sure there's a few here and there, but they're just sort of like little nuggets of history, just sort of like, you know, I for example, there's a few weeks ago you posted a Randy Savage Ultimo Dragon match from 1998 WCW Worldwide. I just love like those little like, oh, I had no idea those two guys ever faced each other. And I like that most of them are shorter matches, just kind of easy to digest, perfect for just surfing YouTube or taking a few minutes at lunch or whatever and watching a wrestling match.
Yeah, I definitely don't want to exhaust someone on the page despite the number of videos. When I set out to launch the page, I had two rules in mind. The first one, no pay-per-view matches, because I think that just kind of opens up Pandora's box for like just wacky requests. And I think we've all seen Hogan Warrior a million times and Hogan Andre and those type matches. Number two is nothing over 15 minutes. Number one, I can't post a video over 15 minutes, but even if I could, I don't want a two-part any video. I just want some nice, quick, self-contained videos. And what I can say, the best thing about the YouTube comments, and I know it gets a bad rap, you know, YouTube comments, scum of the earth, make comments, but really though, a lot of them are positive. And I love it when I read something haven't seen this in 25 years, or I thought it was a figment of my imagination, first time I've ever seen her, didn't know Yoshi Kwan was still in WCW. Just little comments like that kind of make my day.
Yeah, I had no idea about Super Shockmaster.
Yeah, neither did I.
Yeah, that was totally a surprise to me. I had no idea that they had, for those who don't know, basically they're a little bit after the Shockmaster fiasco. They kind of had him wrestle as a sort of a clumsy wrestler, and then they brought in it was Fred Ottman, the same guy, but they brought him in as Super Shockmaster as a different character, as sort of was he the son or the nephew or I forget exactly, but basically he's this heel promo running down the other Shockmaster, and then I don't think they've ever followed up on it after that again. Or maybe they had a couple of Super Shockmaster matches, but it basically, you know, was you know, it was done after a few weeks, but just kind of an interesting epilogue to that famous fiasco in wrestling.
Yeah. I don't know what really became of that. But one thing I didn't have cable back then. So basically it was just worldwide for me. But I didn't realize the Shockmaster's gimmick was that he was a klutz after, you know, obviously the Clash, you know, tripping over himself at the Clash, that his whole gimmick would just become just Uncle Fred the Klutz.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, which is an interesting way to try to salvage that, but
yeah,
you know, he got a War Games out of it, so good for him.
Yeah, and a Starcade.
There you go. Yeah, that's right. So good times. So the match that we're going to talk about is the main event of Halloween Havoc 1994, in a steel cage, career versus career, WCW champion Hulk Hogan defending his title against Ric Flair. The former champion, of course. 11 times at this point, former champion. So, you know, the most of you probably familiar with the big picture of this story. Hogan entered WCW in the summer of 94 in his first match at Bash of the Beach, beat Flair for the title. Flair was sort of had freshly recast himself as a villain, taking on Sensuous Sherry as his manager, the former Sensational or Queen Sherry or Scary Sherry, depending on your preferred term. Michael Buffer likes the infamous Sherry, as I learned here. So, WCW is, I guess, not really that slowly, pretty quickly remade in Hogan's image, kind of becomes a sort of a mix of the traditional WCW, the kind of the focus on wrestling and focus on some of those characters, and then now also becoming a little bit WWF light. They're, they bring in guys like the Nasty Boys, Earthquake, Jimmy Hart, and the former Brutus Beefcake, who's known as Brother Brute-Eye. Mr. T's hanging out a little bit here and there. Guys like that who are very pals of Hulk Hogan and very much associated with him, over his WWF career, and definitely changing the WCW environment that had existed. That was kind of the Flair dominated, kind of pro post Crockett, but still kind of in that Carolina mindset to a certain extent, although WCW went through a lot of different people in charge and directions and talent, between the from late 88 when Crockett sold it to Turner to this point. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that it seems like WCW is sort of trying to serve two audiences, both kind of their traditional fans and then lapsed WWF fans who kind of turned away from it for whatever reason, whether it was because Hogan left or whether it was before then, when just kind of the fad bubble of 80s WWF had sort of gone away, or just WWF not really presenting fresh, exciting matchups for Hogan, or a mix of the two.
Yeah, it really hits you in the face during this main event, considering you had Mr. T and Muhammad Ali and Hulk Hogan all in the main event of Halloween Havoc 94, who are all obviously, involved in the main event of WrestleMania 1. This is almost like the beta version of the NWO invasion.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, it's interesting because yeah, I mean they're gonna definitely toy with this a lot during even pre NWO. I mean, kind of the point of bringing Hogan in is they're gonna recast some of the WWF feuds and kind of and tweak that a little bit, but they're also going to present some of the classic NWA versus WWF star feuds that we didn't really get in the 80s. Hogan Flair, Hogan Sting, Savage is going to come in, and even though he did feud with Flair in WWF, they'll bring that back. Just kind of those guys. As Hogan evolves and as the NWO, particularly when the NWO storyline takes off in 96, they're really going to kind of play with that whole, that whole WWF versus WCW, feud, which obviously was, what fans were kind of clamoring for in the 80s and then happened to a degree in the early 90s, but never really to like in a way that felt completely satisfying.
Yeah, and I thought one thing that was pretty cool about like this era too, that as Hogan and friends sort of come in, that you get to see like the worlds collide as far as like you had feuds like Jim Duggan against Steve Austin, which in hindsight I can sort of chuckle at, but at the time, even at the time as like a 12-year-old, that feud infuriated me. But you had like Johnny B. Bad against Honky Tonk Man, Nasty Boys and Harlem Heat, so it's kind of cool seeing like the homegrown WCW guys. I'm kind of feuding with these, not invaders, but sort of the Bischoff's vision of WCW.
Right, yeah. I mean, and you kind of have the guys who are going to be, of course, on their way out. I mean, Steve Austin's going to be on his way out. I think Cactus Jack is already gone. Vader will have a run with Hogan, and then he'll leave. It's definitely, and of course, those are the guys who are going to refuel the, WWF in a few years, or at least some of them they will go there and not really work out so well, like Johnny Bad, Mark Merrill, for instance. But obviously Steve Austin worked out pretty well. So, but yeah, it is interesting to see those guys around during this time who are associated with the glory days of WWE later Attitude Era or 90 to 93 WCW, like Dustin Rhodes would be another example of that, and then sort of see them how they're being presented in this transitional time.
Yeah, and like Dustin Rhodes, like what a great wrestler he was, pre kind of WWF, part so pre Goldust gimmick. I mean, I didn't really appreciate him as much as I do now.
Yeah.
Now that I appreciate him so much more than I did back then. I mean, the way, I mean, it's kind of a cliche, like connecting with the crowd. But man, that guy did it. Like all you do is look in the crowd and kind of make a fist and sort of give a little smirk, and he had the crowd in the palm of his hands. And I thought he was just amazing, like even up till the end of his WCW run.
Yeah, and obviously he's still pretty great today. So,
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you're seeing some of that like work of Dustin Rhodes in
yeah.
sort of the gimmick of Goldust.
He's really probably more like Dustin than he is like Gold, like the initial incarnation of Goldust. I mean, obviously he dresses like Goldust and maybe does a few of like the Goldust signature things, but really when it comes to how he wrestles today, he's sort of pretty traditional, baby face in the early 90s vein, just kind of the way he and his brother work the their tag matches, I think, wouldn't be would fit pretty well in early 90s WCW with a few adjustments here and there.
Oh yeah, they'd be great. Like Dustin or Goldust now has that get up and go of the natural. And yeah, you're right. Like Dustin and Cody up against, say, like Arn Anderson and Larry Zbyszko.
Right.
That would have been a fantastic feud.
Exactly. Yeah. So as I mentioned, this match is career versus career. And actually, funny, because I'd always thought this was Flair's career, not actually Hogan's career, which would kind of make more sense because Flair would be putting something extra up for the title shot. I guess he could be. I guess you could argue, he should get the he should get the rematch anyway, and they just kind of added the career versus career to because they can't be in the same promotion. But I don't know. I thought that was a little strange.
I think what happened here was after the so they had a rematch at they had the initial match at Bash at a Beach. Hogan wins the title. They had the rematch a month later at the Clash.
Right.
Flair won by count out, and that was the debut of the Mystery, the Masked Man. And I believe Flair ended up stealing the belt, and he kind of just referred to himself as the real champ, and he got suspended by Nick Bockwinkel. So I think it was one of those things where he sort of considered himself the world champ, and Hogan, obviously is claiming the world title. And I think somewhere in there they just decided. I think they went one at a time. I think maybe Flair put his career up first, and then Hogan, or the other way around. But it was like a 2 week series of them sort of putting their careers up,
Okay, there you go.
I think. Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds right. I don't remember the exact particulars, but that would be about where they yeah that sounds right now that I think about it a little bit more. Also, there are slight shenanigans because if you think about it, like this really is like because we have the special referee, Mr. T, also called the special enforcer, but really he's the referee. And obviously he's Hogan's buddy and it was associated with Hogan and in Hogan's corner when he beats Flair. So to make him the special referee does seem like a putting this unfairly in Hogan's favor. So they do have some. I remember there being like some like secret camera footage of like Mr. T and Ric Flair hanging out and like implying that Flair may have been bribing Mr. T or so on and so forth. I guess putting some doubt as to whether Mr. T would be a fair referee.
Yeah, they were caught like hanging out outside Michael Jordan's restaurant, and they kept hammering home that they're outside of Michael Jordan's restaurant so much that part of me thought Michael Jordan was going to play a part in this match.
There you go. Maybe if they were in Chicago instead of Detroit.
Yeah, touche. I don't
Yeah.
know where the Bulls are playing. Or he was tired then, wasn't
Yeah,
he?
I guess he
Yeah.
was. Yeah, that was during his he would be coming back in 6 months or so. Good point. So I guess there's no reason if Isaiah Thomas had come out or Bill Laimbeer had come out, you know, that would have made more sense. So anything else that regarding the build up to the match that you can think of that's worth discussion?
They sort of revealed that there were more than one masked man for whatever that's
Oh
worth.
yeah. Yeah, I guess we can. Yeah, the Clash was interesting because that was actually one of the first times I really sat down and watched WCW because I was intermittently a wrestling fan from like 92 to or maybe 91 to like 97. I'd kind of pop in and out here and there, but it was almost always WWF. I had never really been a WCW fan, but I knew Hogan was back and I knew they were doing Hogan Flair, and that was something that, you know, excited me from the 80s. So I remember checking out that Clash and seeing that angle. I remember that Arn Anderson is pretty much either implied or absolutely shown as one of the masked men.
Yeah, he was never revealed, but like I believe they sort of like I know like right before, may have skipping ahead here, but before they took the hood off of Beefcake's face, like Keenan like just shouts out, I bet it's Arn Anderson.
Right,
And I
exactly.
think it probably was legitimately, I think like Arn Anderson was a legit masked man. I want to say Bunkhouse Buck was like a legit masked man at one point.
Right.
Because they had a match where like Hogan was gonna tear off the masked man's mask at like a main event taping, and then the second masked man came to attack him and
Right.
work on the leg.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So yeah, that was also one of the things is that yeah, they played off the Tonya Harding thing, where or the attack on Nancy Kerrigan by some associates of Tonya Harding, which occurred in '94. So they were playing off of that with the masked man attacking Hogan's leg, and then Hogan's leg is continually attacked and still remains injured during this match as part of the story of the match. So. We our introductions. We have Michael Buffer, who introduces Flair, going through the greatness of his career, also referring to the infamous Sherry, who is wearing, I would say, a reasonably classy outfit. A skirt and sort of a business jacket, black outfit. Although she does have paint on her face, sort of that LOD like paint, silverish, I believe. The announcers, Tony Schiavone, Bobby the Brain Heenan, and I think actually they both do a really good job here. Tony of talking about the greatness of both their careers, particularly Flair, and Bobby being nervous about Flair having a lot of anti-Hogan diatribes throughout, but suitably putting over the stakes of, you know, both men's careers on the line, and getting into sort of the history that both of them have. Tony late mentioning Flair's first title win against Dusty and Hogan's first against the Iron Sheik. When Hogan comes out with Jimmy Hart and Brother Brudai, who is Brutus Beefcake, but they can't use that name, Brudai almost trips over a portion of the stage. Buffer, I always am amused when Michael Buffer refers to Hogan as the King of Hulkamania, which is something that sort of goes against the nature of Hulkamania. Because I don't
Yeah, I
know.
didn't know it was a monarchy, but
Yeah, I mean, I guess I don't really know exactly what Hulkamania is. I mean, I guess it, you know, it may be a monarchy. I mean, Hogan may reign over all of us. I always kind of assumed that it was more of a, you know, democracy. But you know, there are some disturbingly.
not according to that creative control clause in his
Well,
contract.
there you go. There is sort of that disturbing, fascist tendency a little bit with the Hogan worship and everything. So, not to get too political here, but
I couldn't agree more, by the way, about what you said about Schiavone and Heenan. I thought they were fantastic during this match,
yeah.
and sort of during this feud in general. Because like as the match started, like as you said, they kind of had that tone of reverence towards both men. But you could tell, I mean, Heenan more so than Schiavone, but they both had so much like anxiety and urgency in their voices that I mean, this felt like it'd almost be like if Say, the Bulls played the Suns in the NBA Finals, and the loser, Charles Barkley or Michael Jordan can never play basketball again. It was treated pretty straight up as far as that goes. Not too many jokes, certainly not in the opening moments of the match. I mean, it was just pretty much a straightforward, almost, treating it like a shoot almost.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I definitely agree, which is, and Tony and Bobby, definitely didn't have the best relationship, didn't always have the best chemistry as announcers, but this is definitely a time in which they do fit very well together and are definitely on the same page with things, which is helpful.
Yeah, I think the NWO probably just destroyed Bobby Heenan, but because he couldn't be a heel anymore, so.
Yeah, that didn't help. But I think watching some of this old stuff, I do feel like there's some signs of like them of the not being on the same page stuff fairly often, even pre NWO. But that definitely, I think Bobby Heenan's announcing in general declined once the NWO happened. I certainly agree with that. And I noted that it was kind of funny that Hogan gets a bigger entourage than Flair with Jimmy Hart and Bruce Beefcake coming out. Although Brother Brutus does leave without anyone mentioning why he would leave. I mean, I guess he's not. I guess he. I don't know if he would normally be at ringside for Hogan's match. He probably wouldn't normally be there. So I guess he's just coming out for moral support. With Jimmy being out there, of course, as his manager, which it was sort of weird that Hogan like needed to have Jimmy Hart there as his manager. That just seemed like always like a strange addition to me.
Yeah. I mean, like, to me, Beefcake struck me as more of like a mascot to Hogan, even though like Jimmy Hart's the more animated and bombastic one. But at least in like you can say in kayfabe that Jimmy Hart's the one like wheeling the deals, and he signed Hogan to WCW, where Beefcake just seemed absolutely useless up until this point. He just sort of hung around and just made sure the camera saw him, and he would stand behind Hogan.
Sure. Mr. T comes out. He gets to hold up the belt. He and Hulk exchange a few words. I think that Mr. T has a Red Wings shirt on, although I'm not 100% sure.
Yes.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
There you go. The cage gets down, comes down. We get some fireworks and flames from the posts. The cage looks really rickety at first, although I guess the ring crew like kind of tightens it a bit, and it doesn't look noticeably bad during the match.
No, if anything, I'd say like it was just a little short. Like it was only about, a foot or two taller than Hogan.
Yeah, I think the WCW cage was normally like that. I think that was just sort of a normal, yeah, that was their normal cage. It was not very tall. So we actually take a minute or so to get into any sort of action. I guess they are sort of waiting for the ring crew to kind of finish its job. And then Hogan attacks right away with an onslaught of punches. Mr. T breaks it up. He's pretty active in getting involved in this match as far as keeping one guy from attacking another. I guess sort of cheating, although it is a cage match, so that there's no, I guess technically no disqualifications, although they always kind of say with the referee, even in these situations, the referee's job is to kind of keep it as clean as possible. So it does make sense a little bit, and it does serve the purpose of allowing Flair to get a few cheap shots here and there.
Yeah, I was more wondering why Mr. T was carrying around Hogan's laundry like halfway through the match. He was just like list he was just hauling around his shirt. You notice that, or his bandana or something?
I didn't notice him actually. Did he hold on to it like at the beginning, or did he hold on to?
He held on to it for like boy, the first 5 minutes of the match.
Okay, yeah, I there's a certain point during the match in which Hogan gets his shirt or bandana, and I didn't know where it'd come from. So I know I did not notice that T had been holding it, but that is interesting. I guess maybe he just wanted. Maybe T want to keep his hands dry, maybe gets a little
Could
sweaty
be.
there, with the nerves, the bandana helps, dry him a little bit. It's a thought. So yeah, Hogan beats up Flair quite a bit to begin. Couple of running clothesline. He gets Flair in the corner, stands on the turnbuckle and chokes him. And then Flair gets an eye rake to stop the flurry after Hogan and T get into it, but quickly Hogan gets the advantage again, sends Flair to the cage. We get some close-ups of Jimmy Hart and Sherry at ringside. We also see Nick Bockwinkel, and we get a close-up of half of Sting's face and his sunglasses. Flair gets a low blow. Tara gets the leg for a little bit. He and T also exchange words here and there. So T again is showing his forcefulness as referee. We get some shots of Thomas Hearns and Muhammad Ali in the crowd. Flair does get a little bit of offense for a while and tosses Hogan hard into the cage, although I would say the first 5 minutes of the match are roughly 80% Hogan, 20% Flair.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Although I believe it was somewhat early on. Like he had a, Flair had a pretty impressive suplex on Hulk to sort of just yoke him up and keep him just still had like a delayed standing suplex on Hogan, which I thought was pretty impressive.
Yeah, he did. He I would say they normally like their matches generally only reached a certain level. Like I never really got like a they never really got into the kind of gear that any of the great Hogan that any of the great Flair matches would get to. I mean, I think the best Hogan Flair match is merely very good. But I would say they did like I would never say there were like noticeable like bad points in a Hogan Flair match. I mean, they never got better than very good, but they were never worse than pretty good.
Yeah, that's fair, and I think a part of that is because I mean, like with like Flair and Steamboat, they can just sort of just wrestle and wing it. Whereas with Hogan, like you know, he has to sort of like work the gimmick of Hogan and doing the Hulk ups and the no sells more so than like say Steamboat, where they can sort of just feel their way through, and there wasn't like a systematic formula that they had to follow.
I would that's a good point. So, Flair is able to he does Flair does the knee drop on Hogan, and then Hogan stands up and moans and sort of almost does a Terry Funk stagger. Tony, as we mentioned, doing a nice job incorporating the history throughout, mentions the horseman and the four fingers as the sign, which gives Bobby a nice line about holding up one finger for Hogan.
And Schiavone had a line I enjoyed when Hogan was making one of his comebacks. He claimed that Hulkamania was stronger than Flair's plane crash in the 70s. So, you know, Flair could withstand the plane crash, but Hulkamania, that's a whole nother
That's
jar
right.
of beans right
That's
there.
true. Yes. Yes. He did. Maybe not the best comparison there, but
No.
what can you do? Hogan takes control again. He does a battering ram on Flair into the cage. Flair does the flop. Hogan tries to choke Flair with his shirt or bandana. T stops it. Flair's able to catch Hogan with an axe handle off the ropes to take control. Then Flair does, I believe, the vertical suplex you mentioned onto Hogan. Gets two on the cover. Then he struts a bit and gets a big woo. This crowd, I would say, is mostly a Hogan crowd. I mean, there's a few spots where, you know, Flair gets a few woos and you know, maybe a few cheers, but I don't really notice any boos for Hogan.
No backlash for Hogan. I mean, there were Hogan fans, there were Flair fans, but it wasn't as if people were booing Hogan and really even booing Flair, I would say. And like one question about someone in the crowd. Do you happen to know who that blonde lady was in the front row sitting next to Muhammad Ali that really animated like she
I did not notice her, no.
oh
Yeah.
the sequins. She had like a sequins top on. She was very, I don't know, maybe because the cage sort of blocked the vision of her, but like she was so like animated during the rest of the show that like I assume she was like a friend of Ali, but it was
Yeah.
pretty weird. Had
Or
that
maybe the
bleach
power
blonde
of
hair.
Hulkamania was just, you know, consuming her.
Yeah, must be. Must have been.
It's
She
possible.
was very excited.
Yeah.
Very excited the
Well,
whole
you
night.
know, wouldn't you be? I mean, you know,
Oh,
with the stakes that are at where that are you know, on the line here.
She had some very professional looking signs, too.
Ah, well, there you go.
Not trying to imply anything,
No, of
but,
course
you know,
not.
she
Of course not.
went through a lot of trouble to make some signs.
There you go. Well, you know, if you're that excited, you're going to make some nice sides.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Long build.
Yeah, there you go. So, we get a chop and punch battle that Hogan wins with punches. Flair tries to climb to the top of the cage. Hogan then sort of grabs him by the throat, and then Flair crotches the ropes. Hogan then bites Flair into the corner, then he runs into a boot into the other corner. Flair then tries the figure four, but Hogan gets a roll up for two. Flair does a chop in the corner, but Hogan shakes it off. He lands a big backdrop, then sends Flair into the cage. He rakes Flair's face into the cage, then lands a back suplex, and then the pin gets two. There's another Mr. T Hogan exchange. Then Flair tries to climb the cage again. I believe that, Hogan slams Flair's face into the other side of the cage. Hogan chops Flair over and over again, and they're standing on the turnbuckle at this point. And then Flair crotches himself for a second time and then tumbles.
Yeah, there was basically it seems like if he had to describe this match in like 5 seconds, it was Hulkamania runs wild, Flair hits move, Flair poses, Hogan gets up, Flair turns around, and Hulkamania runs wild, and
Yeah.
just repeat that cycle.
And Flair crotches himself. There's a third instance as well toward the end of the match. I feel like that is an indication maybe of the amount of inspiration that these two had for this match, which was not like necessarily like a whole lot.
Yeah, I mean, I think they worked pretty hard.
Yeah, I no, I wouldn't say
But
that. I would say the effort was there in terms of like physical movement and in terms of
yeah.
the bumping and in terms of the selling and all that stuff was fine. I just feel like there's sort of an epic story that is being told in like the commentary and in the presentation and the buildup of like these two huge icons, and this is their career versus career match, and I kind of expect like a certain amount of gravity and seriousness, and a certain amount of kind of like almost like kind of like a mutual respect, like both like these these guys are just like these like I feel like there should have been more of like Hogan, a little bit less of Hogan shtick and a little bit more of like WrestleMania six-ish type of Titan versus Titan type thing. I mean, obviously Flair's a much different wrestler than Ware, but kind of like okay, I guess the best parallel would be like a Macho Man Warrior at WrestleMania 7.
Yeah, Flair never really came across as threatening at all to win this match at any point. That really, I think, as a viewer, you think like Flair's got him, Flair's got him. It just never really happened, even with all the shenanigans that would come later on.
Right. I mean, right, right, we're coming to the kind of the part where he gets the best is where he gets kind of gets a little bit of he grabs the bad knee, hits a knee breaker, a few knee drops. Hogan gets up but can't really walk. Flair tears off the tape. Although we do get a comedy spot with the typical one with Flair shoving Mr. T and then T shoving him down hard so he lands on the floor. Kind of the typical Flair ref spot that Triple H later took. And then Flair, kind of attacks the knee for a little bit longer. And we get Heenan in a scratchy voice. One thing I think that actually kind of helped the commentary here is that Heenan's a little bit hoarse. So like
Yes.
the desperation is like even more intense because,
Yes.
he and he's
Yes.
just
Same with Shivani.
I hate Hulk Hogan, so much. And then we get the figure four in the center of the ring, and then Heenan screams, Gary Michael Cabeta, ring that bell. Just a great,
Shades of Rumble 92, I would say,
yeah. Oh yeah,
in his
definitely.
work.
Yeah. This isn't quite as classic, but
No.
he's channeling the same kind of thing. And
Same energy, I would say.
it's fun, but fun while telling the story of the match and keeping you into the match,
Yeah.
Hogan struggles for a minute in it, I guess, but he looks around, he points his finger in the sky, and he reverses it pretty easily. Flair does go back to the knee for a little bit. Hogan then, kind of a clumsy plowing into Mr. T to do the ref bump. Flair does a back suplex and covers, but then Hogan sort of kicks out, pressing Flair into a prone Mr. T, which definitely doesn't look very good. But then Flair ends up stomping Mr. T a few times to sort of, I guess, to put him out for a few minutes. Sherry climbs the cage, but then Jimmy Hart pulls her down, but accidentally sort of pulls her skirt off while doing so. Sherry then shoves Jimmy Hart into the cameraman to put Jimmy Hart out. This is also this was similar to the end of the first Hogan Flair Bash at the Beach match. So this is kind of channeling the finish of there, where Sherry tried to get involved and Jimmy Hart prevents her from doing so.
Yeah, and it also sort of channeled, I don't know if you've ever seen that Savage Warrior cage match back at they had a match like a couple days after the Rumble when the Warrior lost the title. And Warrior pulled off all of Sherry's clothes in that cage match. So I don't know if they just grabbed that sort of that spot right from that. But I loved when Jimmy took off the skirt because he sort of comes down and he looks at the skirt as if to say, "What am I supposed to do with this skirt?"
Right, yeah, like he had no, yeah, it was just kind of like one of those like baffling moments that they handled that well. And then Sting comes out to prevent her from interfering. Then the masked man comes from underneath the ring with a bat and attacks both Sting and Jimmy Hart, putting them both out, you know, for a while anyway.
Yeah,
Sherry.
Beefcake is stealthier than we gave him credit for.
Yeah, well, okay, I'm pretty sure that this is not Beefcake.
No, of course
Okay,
not.
all right, yeah, because I was confused about that, but yeah, he's skinnier than Beefcake. I looked at the tape later and I'm like, oh yeah, that's definitely not him, because I was confused about, you know, like, right, how
Because he'd have to have snuck under the
right,
ring, changed his
people would have
clothes.
noticed him sneaking under the ring, you know. I guess he could have changed his clothes down there, but so Sherry jumps to the top of the cage, off top of the cage, nailing Flair with an axe handle that, or excuse me, nailing Hogan with an axe handle that Hogan no sells. Flair the but chop blocks Hogan. They handcuff Mr. T. Sherry takes off her jacket, is basically in her bra and pant, well, in her lingerie and panties, I guess you could say.
Yeah. That's not the first time she slapped a pair of cuffs on a guy.
Yeah, there you go. Yes. Sherry and Flair double team Hogan some more. Hogan pops up after a Flair suplex. Hogan clotheslines them both, slams them both. No sells a Flair chop, and then clotheslines them both again. Sherry tries to climb up, but Hogan body slams her down. Hogan and Flair climb up to the top again, and again Flair for the third time in the match is crouched on the ropes. That gets a diminishing reaction each time we see that happen. Then Hogan the Gentleman lands a big boot to Sherry. Flair chops him, but Hogan hulks up, and then you can pretty much guess the rest. We get a big boot, which then Hogan drags Flair close to Mr. T, who's handcuffed to the cage. He lands the leg drop and then sort of lays casually on his back on top of Flair for the 1-2-3.
And Flair looking, just staring at the count, looking like he has all of his wits together, just waiting for him just to pop a shoulder up, but nah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that did not come off like as like, you know, okay, Flair has given it everything he possibly had, but he just didn't have enough for Hogan. It's just like any other loss that basically any other, you know, kind of easy Hogan victory.
Yeah, and I know this wasn't the era of WCW for it, but I mean, if any match could have used a Crimson Mask or two, it would have been this one.
That yes, I that certainly might have been something that would have added some drama to this.
Yeah, and I'm not Mr. Bloodthirsty at all, but I
Yeah.
mean, career versus career in a cage, you know.
Yeah, I'm fine with I'm perfectly fine with wrestling that does not have blood, but I admit it can add drama to a match. There's no question about that. So Flair really does not get a moment to reflect upon the end of his career or any kind of moment of like, you know, or really any like even like a close up at all. He basically like slinks away into the background. Hogan raises Mr. T's hand. He goes to ringside, raises Ali's hand and hugs him. He then gets to the line of to the fans of you got what you wanted, and I hope to hell that you're happy. Then Hogan sort of dances and slinks in the ring for a while. He holds up the belt. He plays to the crowd for a long time, doing the ear cup, trying to get the fans into him. Kind of his usual shtick, other than really, he doesn't really pose at all. I guess sort of the ear cup is like leading to the posing, but we never really see any of that. Schiavone does play a little bit of lip service to Flair. You know, this is the end of Flair's career and what a great career he had and all that, but they really don't do much to make you think like the most important wrestler in WCW history has just retired.
Yeah, it was as if like Schiavone was in mid-sentence giving Flair his just due when the masked man entered the screen and the whole tone of the broadcast changed.
Exactly. Yeah. And so he comes, you see him as he comes in, he has the bat, he slides in, and then just waits forever, like while Hogan is standing there to swing the bat. Finally, Hogan turns around, the masked man swings, Hogan catches the bat, he punches the masked man down, and he unmasks him. And you get the close up and you see who it is right away. It's Brother Brood Eye, and Bobby Heenan has the most convoluted line of that man has butchered a friendship, and we use the word butcher like 20 times. And for those who don't know, he will be briefly known as the Butcher. That will kind of be the name that Bruce Beefcake goes with for into he's going to main event against Hogan at the upcoming Starrcade before he transitions into several other different characters throughout his WCW time in WCW.
Yeah, I loved when Schiavone sort of set up Heenan's next line when Schiavone sort of says he was like a brother to him, and Heenan just with that hoarse voice, like you said, just goes, "I don't want a brother like that." Kind of silly in print, but like to hear him say it was a lot better.
Yeah, they did, you know, I think they did the best they could with it. I just think throwing that butcher catchphrase in and just seeing being so clumsy kind of made that just kind of but yeah, I mean I don't think they did a bad job. I actually,
I thought the next line was actually more convoluted,
which one was that?
where Will Sullivan sort of just kind of shows up just in the
Oh
corner, and
yeah.
he's getting Hogan's starting to get cornered here, and Schiavone yells out how the place is starting to rumble. It's like an avalanche.
Yeah, and then an earthquake comes in. John Tenta, making his WCW debut, and then Heenan says, "Look who's here, the big man," and they don't name him at all. Other than that reference to an avalanche, they don't name him. Earthquake then slams Hogan, and then Sting runs in, chases them out after, you know, a bit of a beat down to help Hogan. He actually grabs the belt of all things. Of course, I knew that this wouldn't happen, but thought like what a wonderful moment it would have been if Sting had held Hogan up and then blasted him with the belt and turned on Hogan here. You know, what a wonderful thing that would have been in an alternate universe, you know.
Yeah, but then Hogan would have squashed Sting at Starrcade. Oh wait, he did that a couple years later.
Well, there you go. Yeah. So Hogan
Was a
slumps.
pretty casual save though by Sting. He sort of ran out, kind of wiped out Sullivan, jumped on the other two, and he kind of ruled the ring in a way.
Yeah, he
Kind of
did.
made Hogan look like, made Hogan look inferior there. I'm surprised Hogan went for that.
Well, I mean, Hogan had been exhausted by, you know, his match with Flair, I guess. So, although Sting had a match earlier too, didn't he?
No, he didn't. I don't think he did. I don't think, 'cause I know he didn't wrestle at Bash at the Beach, and I don't think he wrestled here either.
Okay, I mean, WCW had a habit of paying Sting not to wrestle.
Yeah. Well, at least with the Bash at the Beach, there was a scratched retina storyline behind it. I don't know if it was a
There you
story,
go.
like, because he was supposed to wrestle, I think, Regal, and I don't know if it was a legitimately scratched retina, but that's just sort of the explanation they gave.
Gotcha.
Because Sherry had like raked him in the eyes.
There you go. There you go. So And then we Hogan slumped Hogan is slumped on the ground. Sting helps him out. And then we kind of go to Mean Gene. He really doing a voiceover, can't believe what happened. And then, of course, then the announcers strangely suggest that the masked man was under the ring the whole time, even though we did see Brother Brudai come out with Hogan. So we know that that's not possible. And as we mentioned earlier, it was a different masked man.
And it's
And
weird to think that Ric Flair and Butcher could be in cahoots.
well, yeah, it is a little strange. And you would think that, like, maybe. Well, okay, here's the other weird thing, of course, is that the masked man, he has the opportunity to come into the ring and assist Sherry and Ric Flair in beating up Hulk Hogan and having Hulk Hogan retire from wrestling. Yet he chooses not to do this.
No, he never got it. Yeah, he sort of held that nightstick up
Yeah, he climbed
for
up to
Hogan
he
to run
climbed up
into,
to
but
the top of the cage, but then yeah, he sort of like goes down off camera and then disappears and then comes back toward the end. Like
I guess Flair only bought like 15 minutes of protection, maybe,
there
so
you
like
go.
Butcher's clocked out.
Yeah, that's that Flair being cheap these days. It's
Yeah.
unfortunate. Of course, I guess if
He
he
learned his lesson. He wouldn't be cheap again.
Right, yeah. Well, I guess although if Flair had saved his money better, I guess he'd probably be in better shape today.
He'd still be world champ. I don't think it's that.
Yeah, I don't know. And then we talk, and then Gene also mentions a bit about what a loss Ric Flair will have. Heenan, sobbing about the loss. So they kind of get a little bit in the end, but I would say it's like 20% focus on Flair being gone and 8% focus on the other stuff, which I get. Obviously, you're trying to advance the story and you're focusing on the next thing. And I guess everyone there knows that Ric Flair's retirement is not a real retirement anyway. So, but they should be treating it as kind of a bigger thing, and they do not. And sort of a and sort of that would be if I'm a longtime WCW fan who loves Ric Flair and is a little iffy about Hulk Hogan, invading my space, I can understand why a lot of the WCW fans ended up resenting Hogan quite a
Yeah.
bit, especially as 95 grew into 96.
And it wasn't just Hogan invading their spaces, all of his washouts and but yeah, you're right about, I mean, again, storytelling terms, like, yeah, you want to sort of phase out the old and bring in the new, but I don't think too many fans were sick and tired of Ric Flair and were salivating for Butcher to get his rise through the
Yeah,
promotion.
Butcher seemed like a weird choice. I mean, I will say, okay, the first time I saw this was probably 96 or 97, and I did not know what happened. I mean, I knew Flair didn't win the match, I guess. I didn't know that, but I didn't know that the masked man would end up being Bruce Beefcake and that they would have, a main event. That all surprised me. And that, like, as a longtime WWF fan and kind of knowing the history of Beefcake and Hogan, even like going like their real life history, of being friends for a long time, I did actually like I thought for a moment, oh, that's kind of interesting, that's kind of an interesting way to go. And at that time, I also had a more positive opinion of Brutus Beefcake's wrestling than I do now, just because
Yeah.
like he was kind of a favorite as a kid, and I didn't like.
And he's had good matches as Brutus Beefcake. It wasn't like every match he had was a dud, so he figured like, oh, in a main event program, this guy's gonna step it up and it's gonna.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't like necessarily aware of like how bad he got from his prime to later, and there were a lot of gaps in my wrestling knowledge still. So, when I saw this, I saw it a couple years after it happened, but I almost kind of came to it like with the mindset of a person might have at the time who had grown up a WWF fan, because I didn't really know what the aftermath was of it, so.
Yeah, I'm like you in that way. Because it wasn't so much that I was more of a WWF fan, but like it was just more available through syndication than WCW was. But I recall like a week after this match, there was a like WCW main event while it was on TBS. They also had like a syndicated version that they would air, and I would get that through an out of town station. So it was sort of, and what they did during like the, it seemed like the, I believe it was the commercial bumpers, they would show clips of this match. but they showed them all out of order. So it really just made the match look very captivating. Like, what is this? The craziest match I've ever seen. You know, you'd see like, you know, they'd show like a clip of the masked man doing his interference, and then a clip of maybe Jimmy Hart pulling down Sherry's skirt, and a clip of, you know, Mr. T being handcuffed. Just these quick little clips, like this. Sort of, I think it was maybe to push the home video. I don't know, but they would show them, and it just looked very interesting the way they put them like out of order, if I remember correctly.
Yeah. That sounds sort of like a WCW thing to do. So,
Yeah.
Flair would be back by spring of the next year.
Even earlier than that.
Yeah, so he was not gone for long. Yes, yeah, and would retire, of course. Would sort of retire 14 years later, although would have a few more matches in TNA. I guess, I don't know. I don't know if he'll ever wrestle in WWE again.
I hope not. I
Yeah.
thought it was sort of not fair, like if you think about it, that Flair had to put his career up twice in 1 year, because you know he had to put his career up against Vader at Starrcade '93, and
Right.
you know 10 months later, to do it
And
again.
yeah, and it's so weird.
Oh.
And it's so weird. Like, yeah, there is very little time between like Flair being this inspirational baby face, inspirational hero, family man, like fighting for the title, representing WCW, and beating the evil Vader, and then being like fodder for Hogan. You
Although
know.
I did enjoy how his heel turn went down, because they started teasing Hogan at about March. Don't hold me to that, but I think it was like March when they start teasing him. And Flair would do an interview with Oakland, and he was actually like rather balanced about it. He'd be like, you know, Gene, why are you trying to chase down this Hulk Hogan? You know, he's a Hollywood guy. He's doing movies. Like, I'm the world champ. I'm going around defending this title. Like, come on, you know, you know, who cares about Hulk Hogan? And then, you know, from there, obviously, you know, his sanity would, you know, degenerate, you know, month after month as like the Hogan hype grew and grew. And then he finally, you know, signed with WCW.
Yeah, exactly. I do think that yeah, I mean it does make sense. It just sort of like it's just funny how things can change quickly in wrestling. And the Flair character was malleable in that way that where it worked fine, but and obviously this like was bringing Hogan in was the thing that turned WCW around and made them, eventually into a big success and then an even bigger failure. But it's weird because I do kind of, and I think we might even have a Twitter question along these lines. But well, we'll just talk about it. I mean, I do wonder the alternate universe in which Hulk Hogan never comes to WCW, whether like that adds any time or subtracts any time from WCW's history. I mean, obviously they would not have reached the highs that they reached. But on the other hand, they may have just sort of been like a steady presence that like that I even if it wasn't on Turner Networks, maybe somebody picked them up after Turner decided to cancel them, and they're this just kind of this thing that sticks around and is still around today, essentially sort of being like the small scale thing that if it's is what kind of what TNA is,
Yeah, and I won't. I mean, I certainly wouldn't argue with that, because obviously we'll never know. But I guess my take would be bringing in not even so much like Hall and Nash as talents, but just bringing in that culture that they brought in, just sort of bringing in those attitudes and the whole, you know, want more money, do less work that just seemed to spread through WCW, and that creative control. Which I mean, I get that Hogan was sort of like the first guy, I believe, to get that full creative control, but I mean, Hall and Nash really, I mean, theirs where they would, I believe they had those clauses where they would be the highest paid, and if someone came in to make more money, they would automatically get bumped up. I mean, just contracts like that. I mean, at least Hogan, you can tangibly see him bringing in money. I don't know how much money like Hall and Nash would bring in to justify those contracts. I mean, like, they're entertaining, but boy, I mean, if I had a point to like what ultimately brought down WCW, it's just not, I mean, Hall and Nash and the culture they brought in.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's so many factors, and that's certainly an important one. And I think there was sort of the inmates running the asylum kind of thing. And I will say that I think WCW was a place where the wrestlers had a lot more art. Well, I mean, they had what kind of the thing that you're talking about as well, but they also, I think, had more artistic freedom and more like ability to kind of be creative, but that also like meant they could also like be lazy and there were fewer consequences for it. Like you could do a brilliant thing if you had more freedom to do more brilliant stuff if you wanted to, and that happened a decent amount, but you also had the freedom to be lazy and, you know, and if you were a person who, you know, they favored you, there would be few, if no consequences to it. At least that's what it seems like. So.
And I credit them to some degree for the rise for like that, you know, those, you know, 5-point ratings. But I mean, I don't know how many tickets, I mean, you know, I don't really care about how many tickets, you know, they sell, but like as far as like pay-per-views go, like I don't know if anyone other than Bash at the Beach 96, obviously, like that would be a huge exception. But I mean, as far as them headlining past 96, like I don't know how many, you know, how many people paid to see like Hall and Nash in 97 and beyond.
Yeah, I mean they were obviously popular, and I think they were an important part of the NWO's popularity. But it is kind of hard to like suss that out, like separate those guys. Like if Nash and Hall had left in mid '97, would it have mattered that much to the NWO's popularity or to what, you know, kind of what they
Or
were
could
doing?
yeah, or could they have just hit the reset button and just kind of sort of just gone back to doing wrestling without sort of that irreparable damage of, you know, say the finger poke of doom and Goldberg's winning streak coming to an end and stuff like that.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there's so many things. It's kind of hard to suss all that out. But it's interesting to kind of wonder like if WCW just kind of stuck with being this like small, you know, Southern wrestling promotion that just kind of did its
Center
thing.
stage.
Yeah, and like managed to sort of like cut its expenses and not really, you know, and just kind of be like this thing that didn't really like make a whole lot of money, but they didn't lose a lot of money either, and was able to sort of stay afloat because they provided good TV ratings. And you know, I mean, the one of the big things that Bischoff you know did that was successful for WCW was getting, you know, was getting money for TV rights and getting Turner to pay them for their TV, you know, which they didn't have before then. So that obviously
And I
changed
believe
the game.
didn't Turner like pretty much he paid for the Hogan contract like under like the Turner books and it didn't go under the WCW books.
I think, yeah, I heard, I don't remember exactly, but that sounds like something, you know, kind of along those lines with something they would do. So, all right, well, we have some questions from the Twitter. Let us do that. And interesting one first from Eric Darcy at Hey Darcy, asking about Flair and Hogan. How much more would their match mean if it had happened at WrestleMania?
Oh, okay. I guess I had interpreted that question as something else. Unless there's another question that's. Was he asking about WrestleMania 8 or just any WrestleMania?
Well, I think I mean, I think I'm not sure. I would guess he means WrestleMania 8, but I guess it could be any WrestleMania.
Yeah, I mean, as far as 8 goes, my heart wasn't broken that there was. I mean, I don't remember watching the TV thinking that like can't wait to see Hogan Flair. As weird as that sounds, just because of the way like the stories are sort of progressing. Because you know Flair was the champ, but like, oh, do I really want it? Because I'm thinking like if Hogan's going to WrestleMania, he's gonna win at WrestleMania, and do I really want to see him beat Flair again? You know, and have Hogan run around with that belt again? Because I didn't know anything of the you know him retiring, and even if I did, I just would have assumed like he's not really retiring. So like to me, like Savage and Flair felt like fun, and like Sid and Hogan felt a little better. Is there another question that was about like what era would they have been best during, or did I just like misread that question when I saw it?
Okay, there was another one from Star of Savage. What would have been the ideal time and promotion for a Hogan Flair feud, keeping in mind what we'd lose?
Okay. Well, I'll let you answer the first question.
Okay. The first question, I think that there is evidence, and I haven't really crunched the numbers, but if Flair Hogan had happened at WrestleMania 8, I'm not sure that the WWF audience in 1992 would have been as excited about Hogan and Flair as the 1994 audience in WCW was. Because I think Hogan going to that new environment was really an important part of making this feud a little more interesting. I know Flair and WWF obviously was interesting, but I think a lot of the traditional WWF fans kind of viewed Flair as just kind of like, he's just kind of the typical heel who, like, as not really an obstacle that Hogan would have to worry about.
Yeah, because Flair was even back then was a cartoon character
Right.
in a lot of
And
ways.
people who respect Flair and that tradition have that background in Crockett and, go back to everything, to kind of the early to mid 80s Flair, that Flair is a threat to Hogan. By 92, the Flair that kind of was more the cartoonish Flair and losing to Luger and Sting a lot and not really necessarily getting the most, not necessarily getting the strongest push in WWF. I mean, obviously he won the title. He had that big Rumble thing, and he did come in with the title. So they did do some different things, but like Flair pretty quickly kind of became just another guy there a little bit.
Yeah. And I thought, oh, go ahead, sorry.
So I don't know, but I will say on the other hand, if Flair and Hogan had happened for the first time at a WrestleMania, it would be part of that WrestleMania legacy, and it would be like one of those like matches that like WWF would point to every year as one of those like part of that whole like narrative of WrestleMania being the biggest show every year and being the biggest thing. It'd be on. I'm certain it would be on that list of like great WrestleMania matches, great WrestleMania moments, so on and so forth. But like in 92 and in 94, WrestleMania was still like it was WWF's premier event, but it was not necessarily like automatically the biggest wrestling show of the year. Not even necessarily automatically the biggest WWF show of the year, where obviously it is today.
Yeah, it was like it's a big show. Go rent the video. So that's just it wasn't like I mean I think they did call it the Grand Spectacle back then. But
Yeah,
yeah, I see what you're saying. It wasn't
I mean, it wasn't necessarily
Access Weekend and
right.
stuff like
Yeah, I mean,
that.
there wasn't all that, and it also wasn't like, I mean, it wasn't like the number one show as far as audience wise goes every single year. So that kind of thing,
But I agree. I mean, like, yeah, seeing them face off in WrestleMania with the light bulbs going off. Yeah, that would have been a clip you'd have seen. Hogan, you'd have seen the Hogan Andre, Hogan Warrior, Hogan Flair, Hogan Rock. You'd have seen like those clips. But I thought, like, at this time, I mean, like, to me as a threat, like Mr. Perfect being like the consultant slash manager was more threatening than Ric Flair was, because it was as if you could just stay away from Mr. Perfect, you can take Flair, but it's Perfect's the one that's gonna have the brass knucks, and Perfect's the one that's gonna trip you up and.
See, I will say that when I was a kid and I was roughly 12 then when because I actually kind of I had, my interest in wrestling had been a little bit dormant like toward like I don't know 91 or 92 like I was still watching it but I was watching it less and less but I it was kind of boosted again once Flair came in and sort of the build up to WrestleMania 8 because I was expecting Hogan Flair, and when that didn't happen, that was definitely a thing where like I'm not sure I'm into this anymore. And then when Hogan was automatically leaving, I'm like, well, that was kind of a reason for me to sort of stop paying attention.
Yeah, that's an interesting age. You said you were 12.
I was 12, yeah.
That's an interesting age to like kind of like stop watching wrestling, like because you always hear like people like, oh, once I went to high school and there were girls and I don't have time for wrestling. But it's sort of interesting, like being 12, like that's still like kind of middle school, junior high-ish,
Yeah,
to sort of like.
I guess my friends weren't as into it, and I didn't seem like as cool. And I was probably getting into more. I was kind of getting into baseball more, and music more, and different things that and just I didn't have the time or the interest in wrestling. Now, like I said, I would go back to it occasionally, like every few months, I would check something out, or every once in a while, I would rent a video at Blockbuster and see what was going on. So like, yeah, I would keep up with it from here and there. I was never completely out of it, but I definitely like there was a lot of stuff I missed.
Yeah, that's fair enough. I guess, like, for me, like, it just never, like, I think there was a time in 93 when, like, we just had no wrestling in our area as far on syndication. So, like, I just fell out of it because it was just wasn't available. But, you know, by God, if, like, I'll just rent the same wrestling video from Blockbuster. If they have one wrestling video, I'll just rent it every weekend, you know.
Yeah, that I did the same, or if I had videos, like I watched WrestleMania 4 100 times, you know.
Yeah, same here. That was the first video. My dad brought it home one time because his buddy had it. And this was, you know, at least well over a year after the event happened. But I guess he didn't want the video anymore. And, you know, he probably, you know, my dad probably mentioned it. Like, oh, my son's a big fan. So he probably just gave it to him to give it to me. And, like, oh, man, I wore that. It was taped in LP. So that was a pretty classy move.
Yeah, there you go. Now, was yours the double one?
No, it was just like taped right off pay-per-view.
Oh, okay. Yeah, mine was the same. So
So it had like 15 minutes of intermission like on it.
there you go. Yeah, I had the same as well. So, well, let's talk about the other question that we had from Star of Savage. I guess what would have been ideal time and promotion for a Hogan Flair feud, keeping in mind what we'd lose.
And I sort of thought about this and I went SummerSlam 90 in Philly would be the perfect time. Because Flair would have lost the title a month or two before to Sting at the Bash. And let's just say Flair and Hurd have never liked each other. So say Flair gets out of his contract. And Hogan is out since shortly after WrestleMania 6 doing Suburban Commando. And I know Earthquake squashed him a few times, but I mean, you can have him either just leave quietly, or you can go back to Quake later on if you want to. But I just think like a long layoff for Hogan doing Suburban Commando, and then having Flair jump with a month or two of notice, you know. So like the Bash would be like say early July, I think it was. So you have about 2 months with SummerSlam at the end of August, like that, and with that hot Philly crowd, and I mean that would have been a pretty amazing SummerSlam, you know, title or no title. Like even without the title, I think that would have been pretty epic. And it would have been a good match to book, considering they didn't have faith in the Warrior to draw anyway.
Yeah. I agree. That's pretty good. I was kind of thinking more like fall of 89. Like Flair loses the title to Sting a little bit early, like, you know, kind of after the Funk feud, you know, they just kind of go to Flair and Sting and let, you know, and then let, you know, maybe, or maybe even go do it at Starrcade and then early 90. But I was kind of thinking that, actually, like ideally I was thinking, and obviously this would never happen, but doing a trade, like a Flair Savage trade, and maybe throwing like a few guys in there, like having Flair come in with the Horseman and throwing a few, like throwing like a Tito Santana and, you know, a Hart Foundation into WCW kind of thing.
Yeah, well, the Busters are already in WWF.
Well,
You had
they.
Arn and Tully.
Oh yeah, they still would have been there by then. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I guess it depends. Yeah, I guess it depends what
They
you mean, like fall of
they were there
89
by
or,
they were there by
they were
they
gone
were
by.
there yeah, they were there through Survivor Series. But anyway, I guess kind of the idea is that you would just bump Hogan Warrior another year back, which is not that big of a deal. I think you could have had a Warrior do another year of being an IC level guy and maybe kind of see whether he really sticks, you know, with it, or maybe even, you know, letting Flair do like a giving Flair some sort of screw win over Hogan, and then letting Warrior be the guy who beat Flair, and then building to Hogan Warrior that way. I don't know, something, you know, maybe doing something a little different. In that mind, but I think that would have been a right around the time when Flair was still kind of cooking enough, and that would and they were still kind of close enough to their 80s glory where it didn't feel like, because by 91, 92, when Flair actually went over there, it did feel like a match that should have happened like in 1988, you know, like
Yeah.
that was really like the peak of when, you know, both of them were, I guess even by 88, Crockett was going downhill, but I don't know. At least like in the wrestling magazines that I read, that was kind of where, and maybe I'm pointing at 88 because that was kind of the peak of when I cared the most about it, you know, but I kind of feel like I kind of feel like you're still close enough to that time where that would have worked, and that still would have been kind of a hot thing, where like 92 wrestling was on a downslip, and 94 wasn't that great either, but I guess Hogan being in the new environment gave it a little more life than it would have had in WWF.
Yeah. Well, you do realize if they feuded in 88, you wouldn't get your no hold barred.
Oh, I'm willing to give up no holds barred, but you know, I mean, some people may not. So, you know, I don't want to take that away from anybody.
And I sort of, and for right or wrong, I sort of end the Flair glory year period from like when he cut his hair. Like after he cut his hair, it's almost like a new era of Ric Flair, for better or worse.
Yeah, there. That's definitely. Yeah, maybe it was like Samson, you know, like you lose the hair and it just doesn't have the same magic.
Yeah, but it sounds like we're not far apart.
Yeah, I think that would generally kind of be about the best time, you know. Let's see. Mass Tweeter had he had a number of questions. A lot of them we kind of addressed some of the inconsistencies with the Butcher. One thing he wanted to mention was Sherry. How awesome was she in this match? Which I agree. And
Yes,
then, what
yes.
kind of creep gives the big boot to a woman?
Well, she got into the cage, and I mean, like, in theory, you could say Sherry gave herself the big boot because all he did was just put his foot up. He did not kick her. He just put his foot up, and she ran into
She
his
ran to it.
leg.
That's true.
Yeah.
Well, this sort of go is connected to another question. That will now from Clinton IW or excuse me IYH Clinton IYH as in your house but IYH why do atomic drops to women always get a baby face pop? Now we didn't actually see an atomic drop here, but we did see Hogan put his hands on Cherry a few times and it does get the baby face pop, and you get that, and of course, you know, the men attacking the women in wrestling is always a little bit of a squeamish thing, because we certainly don't want to encourage violence against women, particularly when it's a baby face against you know doing the violent act. But I will say there are some wrestling moves in which that sort of almost feel like they equate to like a pie in the face. And I think an atomic drop is sort of like an example of that. Like, even if when it's
Yeah.
done to a man, it's not
Yes.
really about like it hurting. It's more about like, or I guess it is about it hurting, but it's more about like the reaction of the person who receives it and sort of the uncomfortable judgment.
Yeah.
Like
The
how Rick Rude would sell it, you know?
yeah, or like Rick, sometimes they do the PP dance after they get an atomic drop, and that's a move that really needs to make a comeback.
Yes, agreed. Or like when The Rock does a people's elbow to Stephanie, like at one of the WrestleManias, you know, to end that. That's kind of what that is, you know. That sort of is how that is served, you know. And now, you know, do you treat like an attack on a woman that way? Is that like a good way to do it? But on the other hand, Sherry is presented as not necessarily an equal to the men, but as someone who can handle herself
Yeah, I'm glad you brought
to
that
the
up,
men,
because
and I think that makes a difference over like someone who is just completely like a weakling, you know.
yeah, this wasn't an atomic drop to like Rockin' Robin. This was Sherry. She can handle herself. She can dish it. She can take it out. She'll get up and come back for more. I think it would be presented as kind of queasy if, she takes the atomic drop and just lays down dead. Like, ugh.
Right.
But I mean, she's just gonna get up and come for more and get slammed, and she's gonna get up again and get clotheslined. She's gonna get up again and eat the boot.
Yeah, so that's that there are some circumstances there, and I don't want to call them justifications. I just kind of feel like there is a little bit of like, you know,
She's not presented as like a lady, as like a, you know, as, you know, oh, you don't put your hands on a lady. Like she's almost presented as a character that, like, if you were to sort of use that tone to her, she would just slap your head off.
Right. Yeah, I mean, she is a villain, and you know, and so I don't think it's necessarily completely out of bounds, but I obviously I do get a little squeamish when wrestling goes there, so to speak. So, another good question from Mass Tweeter is why go with the generic Butcher when Hogan Orndorff would have been better from a marketing, nostalgia, and match point of view?
That's a good question, but I guess personally, I hated the Orndorff WCW run, like of 93 to 95, or like I thought, to me, like I know he drew like that big money in 86, and I know it's a beloved feud, but like I always thought that guy was way overrated. He just always seemed so reckless and stiff with guys, and like not in every match, but he just seemed to, I don't know, like he just laid it in a little, and like unsafe. It looked like he was laying it in like unsafe places a lot of times, and I was never like a Mr. Wonderful fan, to be honest with you. Not a big one, at least,
I
you know.
did like him. I do agree that like there are people, and I think they're mostly like the Mid-South fans who thought like who have a higher opinion of him than I do, and maybe it's because I haven't seen the right stuff necessarily. I do think he had a good mix of stuff in WCW, like 92 to 95. Like I think there's some good stuff there. I do agree with you that there's some stuff where it feels like maybe he's coasting a little bit, or I guess your criticism was more of the style, but I do feel like there's some stuff that's kind of eh that he does there.
And I think he was like a hard worker. Like, I'm not trying to like derail that. Like, I think he tried hard, but as far like I think they sort of outpunted the coverage in a way when I mean, they gave him a nice little push those years, and like, the guy just never did anything for me
Well, yeah, I mean, I
in
he,
that era.
but he,
Certainly
but
not
he
in that
was
era.
kind of throw. I mean, he was like he would. I would. Argue. I kind of feel like my opinion of him in 94 would have been like a guy who was like past his prime and was kind of like a mid-level guy now and not really a guy who would belong in a main event. And not that necessarily Bruce Beefcake would have been a guy I would have necessarily thought as a main event, but as like a fresh guy who turned against Hogan and had a story and maybe had that stable of villains around him.
And as it turned out, Butcher was never really a main event. He was never really presented as a main event guy past, December 27th, 1994.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it was kind of one and done to just kind of do it, and it's sort of a transition thing to the next thing. And yeah, I mean, I know Starrcade is thought of as the big WCW show, but really, like after between 89 and until 96, with the exception of 93. Really, Starrcade was not the biggest show for WCW any of those years. Or if it was, it was like a tie, you know?
I mean, it was you were told it was the granddaddy of them all, but sometimes the booking didn't exactly
Yeah,
reflect
I
that.
mean most years there another show would have been bigger, just as big. Like 96 would have kind of been with Hogan Piper would have been the first time that kind of was restored, other than the 93 Hogan or Flair Vader match.
Yeah, and that was a one match show, but I mean I love the Starrcade 93 still the presentation of the show, but go ahead. So.
Sure. Okay, let's see. We actually had a lot of good questions here, which is nice. All right. Do you have any thought? WCW Worldwide wants to know if we have any thoughts on Evad Sullivan.
Yeah, I do. I wondered if this gimmick, the Hulkamaniac gimmick, was a rib on Steve Austin. And I say that because, and I don't remember if it was during a roundtable or like a WCW DVD, but Bischoff said a line when, talking about Austin and him leaving WCW, that how Austin had some lame idea that he would, because of his blonde hair, like team up with Hogan or take on Hogan because they both sort of looked alike. And I wondered if he like pitched that in 94 and they decided to like give Dave Sullivan that gimmick, but make him, mentally, slower than the others, as if to say this gimmick is so dumb we have to give it to someone that, can't count to 10. I don't know.
Yeah, I've never heard anything about the origins. I like that theory though. Even if it's not true, I like it. So, I don't know. It's been a long time since I've seen any Evad Sullivan. I didn't really think much of the performer. I guess it was fine for like low level kind of
It
comedy
was easy heat
sympathy
because,
stuff. Right.
it was easy
Yeah.
heat for like them to. He was like the fall guy, in the six man tag, and he got his boots torn up and his hair cut off.
Sure, right. I mean, It wasn't like a dominated promotion, I guess. So it was just sort of like a little thing that they did. It wasn't like I didn't think much of it, but it wasn't really like the worst thing in the world.
Yeah, and at the risk of handing out orange slices to the guy, I mean, I really did like him during the DDP arm wrestling feud. I don't know if you are familiar with that from '95.
Vaguely.
Okay, like DDP would just beat jobbers in arm wrestling contests week after week. You know, the winner, you know, if you can beat DDP, you get a date with the Diamond Doll. Sullivan eventually challenged him, but he had to face Max Muscle first. So, you know, he lost to Max, then he lost his poor piggy bank, and Kimberly felt so bad because Dave Sullivan wanted to take her to the King Lion, you know, instead of the Lion King, called it the King Lion. And Kimberly was really excited, and then they went out, and then eventually he beat him. I think it was at a Great American Bash. He beat him in an arm wrestling match and took her out on a date, and it was kind of a fun little, you know, summer storyline for the guy.
That sounds kind of nice. I'll have to check that out. Do you have any of those videos up on your YouTube?
I'll have to put the date up online. Like that'll definitely be something that
Okay. Yeah,
be worth checking
I
out.
let's check that out. Yeah.
Yeah. His Disco Inferno actually shows up in that vignette as a bunny before he ever he's like a bunny gram.
I think I saw a clip of that, or
Okay.
like a still of that. Maybe you posted it,
Yeah, I did.
okay.
'Cause I was watching, I was just like, oh my God, that's Disco Inferno.
There you go. There you go. All right. Kyle Bruce at Bruce Tanaka wants to know, why in the hell did Flair agree to always put Hogan over? Well, because Hogan was the much more valuable commodity, honestly.
It was a well-paying gig.
Didn't really, yeah, I mean, didn't really have a choice. If he had refused, they would have just, made him or gone with other options. I mean, Flair was obviously important, but who was more important of the two to WCW at the time, and throughout the rest of Hogan's run in WCW, it was definitely Hogan.
Yeah, and I think some of this treatment too, like maybe may have you know, 'cause I know he said like in his book how he's had confidence issues, and I mean I'm sure it didn't help having to like lay down night after night for Hogan, but I mean, you know, it's a well-paying gig, and you know, like if you go to your job, you're gonna do what your boss tells you, and you know, even if you think it's dumb, I mean, you're probably just gonna follow through with it as long as the paycheck's clear.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Flair was a villain in the story. I mean,
Yeah, yeah.
you could argue that the story could have been crafted in a different way, and I would argue that probably. But I mean, in the end, that Hogan is going to be the guy who wins, and Flair's going to be the guy who loses. And yeah, you could have done it in a way where maybe Flair gets a few in here and there, or at least they're presented kind of more equally. But in the end, it wouldn't have changed it that much.
Yeah, and I mean, and as far as actually going to work, at least, you know, if you're going to take on Hulk Hogan, and the feeling I'm sure obviously was mutual because Hogan, you know, handpicked his opponent, that you're going to have a safe night and the fans are going to be into it.
Right, exactly. And the fans were very into the match. They were invested the whole way. So,
Yeah.
all right. Chad Forney, who is at Rad Chad number 4 NAY, wants to know our opinion on Hogan's wrist in sweatbands.
Can't say I noticed.
I have never, yeah, I until I actually took. I did a Google image search of Hogan. I mean, like, oh yeah, okay. He obviously has them now. He obviously has them as I look, but I've never really like thought like, oh yeah, Hogan has like sweatbands along his wrists. So, I've never had a strong feeling about them. Apparently, Chad is not a fan of them at all. But yeah, I don't know. It's not like a. I feel like it neither really adds nor detracts. I mean, I guess there would be or I guess they may have had the word Hulkster on them and they didn't look like his normal ones. Because normally they have the white ones, you know?
Is he referring to like this match particularly or just in general?
Well, I didn't really clarify that. He said it seemed like a cheap marketing attempt with Hulkster on them. So my guess is that maybe it's referring to the ones he had in WCW.
Yeah, we had all that new like Hogan merch.
Right, and it looked like it did look a little bit like some of it looked like a cheap imitation of like the other Hogan, merch. So I don't know. Yeah, I mean some of that was sort of like looked like like a knockoff. It didn't look like authentic, even though obviously it was.
Yeah, I mean, it's no cheaper than a John Cena entrance, so you know.
But as
As
far,
far as the merch goes, you know.
yeah, but I don't know. As far as like themselves, I thought they, I never thought anything of them other than, they're just kind of part of his uniform.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. And then our last question is by Brian Smith, who is PHLYIN Brian with a Y. Would this have been a suitable retirement for Flair, not only losing to Hogan, but calling it quits in 94? I would say no. I think we've kind of outlined the reasons for that,
Yeah.
but.
Not even necessarily like the story would be bad, but the way the match went down would be horrible if he actually went out this way. I mean, if he lost a match to Hulk Hogan in a cage in a, 30 minutes, blood, sweat, tears, that wouldn't be so bad. But the way it, as it was presented at Halloween Havoc, that would have been just an awful way to go out.
Yes, I completely agree with that.
Because, like you said, a lot of the match, especially later on, was played for yucks.
Right. Yeah. I mean. It, yeah. I mean. We definitely talked about that, but I do feel like this. There's nothing. This match is perfectly entertaining, I guess. There's nothing really wrong with it. The work is fine. I mean, it's what you expect from Hogan and Flair. I mean, they're both doing their shtick, and it's definitely a lot of shtick, but. I didn't dislike it at all, but for what they're tr what for the moment it felt very much like the wrong match. Like it had the wrong tone. It had just like the everything about it just didn't feel like, okay, this is a match between the two greatest professional wrestling legends ever with their career on the line. It felt like just kind of a goofy comedy match, you know?
Yeah, like I thought it did feel like that until like the opening bell rang.
Well,
Like I thought the lead up was great. You know,
exactly. Yeah,
they had Bill Shaw in the ring with Muhammad Ali, and they did a little ceremony with Bischoff and
Okay, yeah, I didn't I mine didn't have any of that. I'd
okay.
forgotten about if you want to actually talk about that, if there's anything more to it that is worth mentioning.
I mean, there wasn't really anything terribly noteworthy. I believe like Bischoff had, I'm just kind of going off of memory, had like a plaque that he read to Ali. And they shook his hand and, but I mean, it was just a little segment to sort of just build up to the main event because it was the last thing they, and then they went back to the announcers and like I had the home video version. So they actually went to Hogan backstage and just kind of cut like a kind of a mellow promo to the camera, like mellow, but still like Hulkamania type mellow. So it wasn't like he was shooting or anything like that. And then they sort of went to the match, but like, the entrances and obviously Michael Buffer's going to make any match seem like a big deal, with his zaniness. But that's why I didn't even catch that, like the infamous Sherry, because like he says so many like wild things during his intros over the years that like, I'm just completely numb to them.
Yeah, I unfortunately did not. I didn't notice the camera on Buffer. I tried to make a note of his ensemble, but unfortunately, I did not. I was not able to capture that this time. So we'll just have to use our imaginations.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Mike. Of course, feel free if you want to tell people anything else about your YouTube channel or anything else that you're involved in, that this would be a good time to do that.
Oh, cool. Yeah, the YouTube channel now is at the with the backslash, you go Mr. Monsoon Classic, so all one word. I got about 1,800 videos up. Right now it's skewing WCW just because like I've kind of posted all the WWF stuff that I kind of want to post. I mean, that's if I could really dig down deep in like the squash matches, but I don't want to just post a squash match just to post one, unless if it's like a little known superstar or something interesting happened in it. So it's sort of skewing WCW now. My Twitter is at Monsoon underscore classic. And if anyone's in the Cleveland area, come March 14th, come on down to Turner's Hall because there's a promotion, Absolute Intense Wrestling, that it's gonna have Gauntlet for the Gold, which is basically a 30-man Royal Rumble style match. Hopefully, don't get sued for saying that one. But yeah, so it's basically like a Gauntlet match. The winner gets a title shot, and I mean, the shows are a lot of fun. Like to me, like I always kind of thought of an AIW show as being a sort of like a mix of like Memphis, ECW, and Mid-South in a way. So if something like that sounds interesting, check them out. They're on Twitter at AI Wrestling, and they have a YouTube at the same address. So it's something that if you're in the Cleveland area or just want something new, just a new promotion to sort of try out or even just come out for like a good time. Like it's like a party like every month. So something to like kind of put in the back of everyone's head.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for being on the show, and always enjoy the stuff that you post. And even, obviously we've got this WWE Network thing coming out, and so we'll have access to all these great pay-per-views and a lot of this programming, but your channel still really serves as a nice complement because, again, it's just, all these different not quite random, but all these different, interesting little nuggets and small matches that, someone watching the network isn't likely to be able to find. So it's a nice, compliment even to a service like that. So it's definitely worth checking out, even if you feel like you have all the wrestling you can handle in other places.
Yeah, I really appreciate those words, and I really thank you for having me. It was a lot of fun.
No problem, man. Thank you so much. And of course, everyone, appreciate everyone listening. We haven't been real regular in episodes for actually quite a long time now, but it looks like we might try to do some more with the WWE Network coming. As I'm recording this, it's less than a week from actually happening. So since this podcast tends to focus on pay-per-view main events, that will be we'll have now have access to all of them, be able to watch them conveniently. So that will probably lead to more podcasts, and so I'm looking forward to doing that and having some new and old guests around to talk some wrestling with in a fun and positive way. So yeah, you guys, of course, can check out. I'm active on Twitter at WrestleSpective, also at Jason Mann Ohioan for mostly non-wrestling stuff. And WrestleSpective can be found at iTunes and Stitcher. Always appreciate ratings and reviews, particularly in iTunes. It helps people find the podcast, and can subscribe via RSS as well. If you check out WrestleSpective.com or check out my Twitter bio, you can find all that information there as well. So, thanks again for checking us out, and until next time, see you at the matches.